Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, celebrating 20 years dedicated to advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, Fresno Mayor Lee Brand says he wants to create 10,000 new jobs in the city. We'll find out how Amazon.com plays a big role in that plan and what the big obstacles are. We also talked to the husband and wife team of winter rangers in Yosemite National Park who spend the winter alone in Tuolumne Meadows. They have quite the story to tell in this historic snowfall year. We'll find out why Kern County firefighters are under new scrutiny, as the county says some are using too much overtime. We'll talk to County Administrator Ryan Alsop. Plus, National Spelling Bee winner Ananya Vinay joins us, a very talented 12-year-old who already has her sights set on her next big accomplishment. We'll find out what that is a little later in our program. Right now, though, we pick up with the latest installment in our series, Contaminated, in which we explore the 300 California communities that lack access to clean drinking water. When we began the series, we introduced you to the community of Lanier, which has arsenic-tainted water, all while a treatment plant in the center of town sits idle. Today, FM 89's Ezra David Romero and Carrie Klein return to Lanier to learn why infrastructure projects aren't always enough and how Sacramento is trying to ensure Lanier never happens again.
Water problems have plagued the Fresno County community of Lanier for so long, it may feel like there's nothing left to do but joke about them. Like when I spoke with a group of Lanier residents earlier this spring.
He's asking if you want a glass of water.
Isabel Solorio is the president of the group Community United in Lanier. She advocates for basic services here, and she's fought to get clean water for decades. She remembers when the treatment center was built in 2007.
Cuando la pusieron, para nosotros era una alegría.
She's saying when they built it for them, it was an exciting occasion and it was good. This unincorporated community of 600 near Lemoore is surrounded by rows of pistachios, alfalfa, and cotton. It lacks some basic infrastructure like sidewalks and streetlights, which is one reason it was a big deal to get something as big as a new treatment plant. But just 6 months after the plant was built, the locally elected Lanier Community Services District had to shut it down. Filtering and treating the water were more expensive than anticipated, and Lanier racked up $100,000 in debt. Solorio is saying that on her part it felt disappointing, because she believed that they were in a place where things worked.
So why did this happen? How did Lanier get to be in this situation? To find out, we turn to a local expert.
Hi, Leadership Council, this is Veronica.
Veronica Garibay is the co-director of the Fresno-based Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability. She's been working with Lanier for almost a decade. Garibay says this project failed on multiple levels. Lanier residents didn't know how to navigate the bureaucratic system, and the county and feds didn't look beyond the price tag for the initial construction to consider the cost of maintenance that the community couldn't afford.
The county didn't do its due diligence to really look at what was happening in drinking water. They rubber stamped $1.3 million without looking at the implications of that.
The state and federal government do offer funding options to cover one-time construction projects related to drinking water, but that's not the end of the story. Operating and maintaining these systems can raise water rates prohibitively high. Communities across the state are having to turn away from those projects because they can't scrape together the funding for long-term costs.
There's now a bill in the state legislature that could provide long-term funding for projects like this. Carl Carlucci is a local supervising sanitary engineer for the California Water Board, and he says funding like that could have made a big difference for Lanier.
That is, unfortunately, the poster child for what we do not want to see happen again.
Lanier's unfortunate situation is one of the reasons why Senate Bill 623 was introduced earlier this year. If signed into law, it would establish a safe and affordable drinking water fund, essentially a pool of money available for long-term costs for water systems. That's because
there are no programs right now to fund O&M. So the idea is to come up with a funding source that could be given to the administrator so that they would have enough money to properly operate and maintain the water system.
When a community needs clean water, it can explore a few options before it ends up like Lanier. First, Carlucci says the water board can try to extend water lines from a nearby community. Next, they can consider drilling a new well to hopefully tap into cleaner water. Lastly, the board can fund either household treatment options like reverse osmosis systems or a large-scale treatment plant.
The last thing we really want to do is burden a disadvantaged community with treatment. Typically, you know, it's like Lanier. They usually struggle to afford those costs.
That last resort is where SB 623 and the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund would come into play. The fund would be managed by the State Water Board and would be available in the form of grants. So how much money would this fund need? Jonathan Nelson with the Visalia-based Community Water Center advocated for this bill, and he estimates a few $100 million per year.
Which sounds like a lot, but really, in the grand scheme of California's economy, that's an extremely small amount. We would be talking about cents on Californians' water bills, under a dollar.
Nelson says one of the most urgent priorities is to figure out where the money would come from. One way could be to charge a fee to water polluters.
Other ideas include creating a new sort of safe drinking water fee that would go on Californians' water bills.
That kind of fee is not unheard of in California. When it comes to telecommunications like phone and internet, most of us already pay a so-called lifeline fee to help lower the cost for disadvantaged Californians. SB 623 has passed the state Senate and is currently waiting for a vote in the Assembly. If Governor Brown signs it into law this year, Nelson says it could be up and running within the next few years.
But this fund wouldn't solve the drinking water problem for everyone. Sue Reese is a community development specialist with Self-Help Enterprises, a nonprofit that helps rural areas address water-related needs. She says communities like Lanier face more obstacles than money. They're small, remote, tend to have a lot of Spanish speakers, and they're run by volunteer water boards.
And so frequently the staff people have minimal or limited capacity and knowledge to run these systems too. Would you be able to go run an arsenic treatment plant? I wouldn't, and I work here.
Even though SB 623 could have helped Lanier years ago, getting their treatment plant up and running is no longer their fastest or cheapest option. The board has approved funds for two wells and a system of new pipes throughout the community. With this system, Lanier could have clean water by the end of the year. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Fresno Mayor Lee Brand says he has a vision to create 10,000 new jobs in Fresno and drop the unemployment rate to 5%. That would be a significant accomplishment for a city whose unemployment picture is routinely above the state average. One major piece of that vision fell into place last week. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess spoke with the mayor about that big business announcement and how Amazon.com factors into his larger plan for the city.
So we have a big announcement with another distribution center coming to Fresno. What's up?
Amazon has been a lot of work for a lot of people over the past six-plus months, from Larry Westerlin and his staff at Economic Development, other city staff, Leanne Eager and EDC staff. Everything came together, and there's been a lot behind the scenes, particularly the last two or three months, in getting the site ready, getting permits, and going through all the bureaucracy you have to get this this site shovel-ready. So, very pleased with Amazon. I think they're a good fit for Fresno. I flew there, three or four months ago and saw a tour of their plant. I was very impressed by the operation, not only the plant itself, but the international operation of Amazon. So I think it's a great partnership, the city and Amazon. And we believe start out with 1,500 jobs, and we have the capability to move up to 2,500 jobs.
What is it that's going to take place? What's the actual work that's going to be going on in the facility?
Well, they're going to e-commerce. I understand they're going to specialize in smaller items because remember, Amazon does about everything. They ship you know, books. They ship big screen TVs, microwaves, bicycles. And when you see the fulfillment center that I saw in Seattle, and this is going to be the same type of setup, they're computerized to the point, they're so proprietary that they don't even let you take pictures inside their plant. And so they're going to be shipping items out of this plant from Fresno. And their market, if you look at a map, within one day they can ship out to an area up to about Seattle to the north to about, you know, the border of San Diego and the Nevada and Oregon. So you got probably 50, 60 million people. And remember, Fresno is the center of the state, next to major transportation, 99. When the three-hour drive, you're probably within about 30 million people. So there was no coincidence they chose Fresno.
This was a big part of your budget presentation, which was not just all you mentioned Alta, you alluded to Amazon, but you also right. talked about going forward, trying to position Fresno to attract more of these facilities. So the question is then, is what's next? Is the infrastructure and the space in place for more of these facilities to come in?
No, there's more work we need to do. And I've got a city staff dedicated meeting every few weeks to evaluate, you know, and prioritize what we have to do to make this site, which is roughly about 1,000 acres in that reverse triangle of Highway 99, 41, between Central and North Avenues. So we have our work cut out for us because my goal in that area there, and it could be a little beyond that area, is to have 10,000 jobs in the next 8 years in my time as the mayor of Fresno. And to do that, we have to prepare it right. Again, it's not by coincidence that these things happen. You have to be prepared. You've got to invest the money. I need to go to, you know, Washington and to Sacramento to get help as far as infrastructure money, you know, freeway interchanges, road widening, that kind of thing. But I think the incentives that I wrote a year ago in the Economic Expansion Act, particularly the performance-based incentives where you get breaks in sales tax and property tax based on bringing new jobs to Fresno, all that is working. And it's going to take a focused effort by me and my staff to make sure we can achieve that goal. And the reason I brought that out in that budget presentation, because I gave a one-year budget and I gave a 10-year plan or an 8-year plan to really totally transform the city, to change the narrative from generational poverty, high unemployment, high crime, to finally say Fresno is on the map. We're changing things. We're giving people opportunities. We're taking people off of public assistance, giving them jobs, making them see part of the American dream. And my goal is to bring us, with 10,000 direct and probably at least another 10,000 indirect, 20,000 jobs would bring us under 5% unemployment. We've never been there before. And that is the game changer. I mean, that really is a fulfillment of my vision for the city of Fresno.
I know these facilities, they have a tendency to snowball, like one happens, then two happens, and then next thing you know, there's a bunch of them. Mm-hmm. But do we have the workforce in place to fill those 20,000 jobs?
Well, yes. I mean, what I've been doing the last 3 or 4 months is meeting with people like Dr. Joe Castro from Fresno State, the State Center, Junior College, Workforce Investment Board, Economic Development Corporation, Fresno Unified, and make sure we have this, you know, supply chain of jobs that can come in and fill these needs as they come in. There's generally at least a 12-month ramp up, you know, by the time you sign the contract and start the work, and when you know get the facility finished and get people started. And the good thing about a lot of these e-commerce jobs, you know, it's a high school diploma and some experience in computer operations. So a lot of people are going to qualify. The training won't be that difficult. But it gets important that we make sure all these jobs are local jobs. It's not just Fresno. There'll be job people from Kerman and maybe Selma, Kingsburg, those kind of things. But it has a tremendous impact on our economy. And the ripple effect will be, you know, felt for years to come.
Yeah, we've done some reporting here at Valley Public Radio about these distribution centers and the fulfillment centers specifically, and it's pretty surprising to me the level of upward mobility someone can have through that kind of work and the complexity that goes into it. I mean, it's not just moving
right.
boxes around.
Well, you take Amazon, for example. I believe they start about $15 per hour. That's the starting wage. They've got full health, dental, and vision coverage, 401ks. I think after 1 year, you qualify for 95% of you. If you want to, you know, improve your education and get a degree, they'll pay for 95% of the cost. They're really a good company to work for. They're global. There's tremendous opportunities for people to start out. Again, that's just the starting pay. And those are the kind of employers that Fresno needs.
The downside of Amazon, though, is that to a large degree, it's contributed to the decline in the retail economy, the brick and mortar retail economy. So are we just moving jobs around by supporting Amazon? Are we just moving them from brick and mortar retail over to someplace else instead of creating net new jobs?
Well, for Fresno, there's no question we're creating net new jobs. Now, by having a distribution center in Fresno, does it mean there's a retail store in Ohio that lost 50 people or one in Indiana? Because what's going on across the country and with some of the older companies like Sears and JCPenney's that have not adopted to changing, technologies and styles is that they're losing, and right now, which is amazing, is that the e-commerce accounts for roughly 8% of total retail sales. That shows you the tremendous potential for other companies to expand into e-commerce. A good example is Walmart. I think Walmart at one time was getting hit pretty hard by Amazon on their e-commerce model until they said, we need to start e-commerce. And they've got 1 million square foot fulfillment centers. And in fact, hopefully one day they'll come into Fresno and be a part of that business park. But that's just a change in the economy. For Fresno, I don't think we're losing jobs. These are net new jobs to Fresno. But that's what technology does. You were in the video business 20 years ago, and you were selling VHS or renting VHS tapes. You're out of business because you didn't change. If you were a bookstore and you have streaming downloads right now, you've got to change with technology. And I want to position Fresno to be in the front of this technology.
So I was going to ask if there's any hints about people coming up. Was the mentioning Walmart there a hint about other companies that are sniffing around?
Well, there's others that are out there that were. And then when you're successful, you've brought in two major retailers. We had a third that almost came here, and they didn't come here because of their own reasons. Then Fresno's on the map. And, I said before, success breeds success. And we have a list of the job site locators, both independent people as well as those who work for companies. So every time we land like Ulta or Amazon, they're going to know that Fresno landed, and they're going to say, maybe I should look at Fresno. I'm missing something here, and I'm going to capitalize on that.
Fresno Mayor Lee Brand, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Fresno's Ananya Vinay is the top speller in the nation. A student at Fugman Elementary School won the Scripps National Spelling Bee last week in Maryland. She joins us now on FM 89. Ananya, welcome.
Hi.
What have the last few days been like for you? You win the contest the middle of last week, and now all of a sudden you're on a media tour with stops on all these TV shows. What has it been like?
It was really exciting to win, but it was really hectic after that. But still, it was a really fun experience.
When you prepare so much for a competition like that, is it a big relief to have it over? Or what's it like to win that big title?
Well, I've always wanted to win, so it's really exciting to win. But still, I'll miss studying every day and so on. It's been like a routine.
So do you keep studying? Have you still been studying after the competition?
No, I haven't had time yet.
When will you pick that up again?
I'm probably going to try to do stuff for spelling in Fresno, help my spelling team at my school in Clovis Unified, and maybe start a blog or a radio show on words or stuff like that. So I'm still going to try to keep up with spelling.
Have you had a chance to talk to any of those members of the team since you won? How excited are they?
I haven't really got a chance to talk to them yet, but I hope I will soon when I get to Fresno.
You talked about having a blog and writing about words. What are some of your favorite words in terms of word origins and things like that? Do you have particular languages or roots that are particularly interesting to you?
Well, to me, words with stories behind them, like Greek or Latin mythological words, or words that have really bizarre language. Sounds that don't follow rules at all. I just like the sound of those words and how they're spelled.
So I can understand how you learn to spell, again, a word that has a Greek or Latin root. But what about those words, like you just said, that don't follow rules at all? How do you practice and learn those?
I just memorize them. They don't have a story. And I type them up and I listen to them to feel the spelling. And then so that puts it in my mind.
How do you go about practicing? You mentioned your group that you have at the school in Clovis Unified, but I understand you also have a practice group online. How does that work?
Well, there's all these spellers that have made it to the National Spelling Bee, and we all just chat and talk about stuff. And we also do just random quizzing for fun, and it's just really fun to be with all the spellers who understand what it's like to spell.
Is there any particular type of word that is most challenging for you?
Well, if a sound is tricky, or if it doesn't follow rules, if there's a lot of possibilities for a sound, and you can't tell which way it's spelled, then that's a really good word. Like chifuncto, which I got in the B, like it generally follows German rules, but the beginning, it's in German, like straight out German, doesn't always use like a TCH. It normally uses TSCH, and which is why it's kind of unusual for it to begin with a TCH.
When you're in the competition and they're giving you the words that you have to spell, when you hear that word, do you sometimes know, oh, I know I got this, this is good, I know this word, or sometimes do you have to pause and really think about it?
Sometimes like I feel the word, but I don't remember right away, so I have to think a little. Other times I don't know the word and I try to figure it out, but at least this year I got all words I knew.
So what happens when you come back to Fresno? What do you have planned for the summer with your family?
Well, we're planning to go on a visit to Orlando and San Diego this summer, and just we're going to stay at home, relax a little, invite friends over and have some fun, go swimming, normal summertime.
That sounds like a great summer. And then next year is a big one for you because you're going on to middle school. Is that exciting as well?
Yeah, I'm going to have a chance to do so much more things like electives and all that. It's going to be fun to have different classes for once. And I hope to join debate and all that.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun. Are you already thinking about college?
I just hope I get into college in California, maybe Stanford.
That sounds like a great option. Is this something you're already looking forward to next year's competition?
I can't participate next year, but I'm definitely gonna go there because the champions are invited, and I'm just going to cheer everyone on and all that. Because once you win, you can't compete anymore. But I'm going to just help out with spelling and make it more popular and make a website on interesting words, probably. And I'm not going to stop, like, doing spelling, even if I'm not competing.
Well, we're going to look forward to that website. Before we go, how excited are you about the Golden State Warriors? I understand you're a big Steph Curry fan.
Yeah, I'm really excited that we both won on the same night, and I hope they keep on doing well. And I got invited to their fifth game next Sunday.
Oh, that is great. Well, we'll look for you there at that game and also look for that blog when you get home. And I'm sure that many people are going to be really excited to see you once you're back here in the Valley. Again, Ananya Vinay, the winner of the Scripps National Spelling Bee last week in Maryland, the sixth grade student at Fugman Elementary School in the Clovis Unified School District in Fresno, joining us on Valley Public Radio today. Ananya, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and talk to the Yosemite Rangers who spent all winter alone in Tuolumne Meadows. Plus, what do Kern County leaders hope to find by hiring an outside company to evaluate the practices of the Kern County Fire Department? It's all about overtime. We'll talk to County Administrator Ryan Alsop. That's all coming up straight ahead on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. It's early June, and Yosemite's Tioga Pass Road isn't even close to opening. That's thanks to the record snowfall that hit most of the Sierra this winter. Near the top of the road is Tuolumne Meadows, one of the park's most beautiful sites, nestled among high Sierra peaks and pristine alpine lakes. If it's still a winter wonderland there now, imagine what it was like in the middle of winter. Now imagine spending the entire winter there alone in Yosemite's high country. That's exactly what our next guests did this year. And boy, do they have a story to share. Laura and Rob Paluski were the Tuolumne Winter Rangers there this year. The couple spent the entire winter at the Meadows, tending to the park's historic buildings, measuring snowfall, and going on ski patrols. They join us now on Valley Public Radio. Laura and Rob, welcome.
Thanks for having us, Joe.
Thanks, Joe. It's good to be here.
So this wasn't your first year as the Tuolumne Winter Rangers. How did this year's experience with all the record snowfall compare with other years?
Yeah, it was quite an experience, as you might imagine. This is our sixth winter doing being the Tuolumne Winter Rangers, and we've had quite a mixed bag of winters season since then, including 2015, which was the driest winter on record. This winter, the winter of 2016-2017, it was quite an experience. In the first 3 weeks of January alone, we measured 208 inches of new snow in our front yard in Tuolumne Meadows, and that was unlike anything either of us had ever experienced. We've been working in the winter ski jobs now for over 20 years, primarily doing ski patrol. And it was quite an experience, just to feel the wrath of Mother Nature, if you will.
So, Laura, if you could walk us through what a typical day would be, and what are the living accommodations there? How isolated are you from the rest of the park and the rest of the world at that point in the middle of winter?
We are located, in Tuolumne Meadows, but on foot or on ski or snowshoe is about 16 miles from the nearest trailhead to the east or west. And most winters, it's just a regular Nordic ski to get out there, but this winter the road was really avalanche prone, and visitation was dropped quite a bit as a result. But I guess a day in the life in January, February was pretty much waking up, having coffee and going out and shoveling just to keep our house and roof and generator room and woodshed from collapsing. But it was in a normal winter we live like most modern people in a house with normal amenities. But this year the power went out, and so we had to melt snow for drinking water and doing dishes and cleaning up. And the solar panels that are normally back up, there wasn't much sun for 2 to 2.5 months straight. So it made it a little bit more challenging, but it also made it a little bit more romantic, if you will, and made us feel more in touch with the elements out there and remind us of why we're there. So it was pretty special in that regard. It was very physically demanding, but very rewarding at the same time.
So you did not have electricity for a good portion of the winter. Do I understand that correctly?
We had some electricity. We didn't have phone service. We had limited internet with a use of a propane generator. But since we didn't know how long we would be without power, and we have other needs for the propane, just powering lights and such, that worked. And then when the sun finally did shine in March, we were able to use solar power to get more back on the grid, if you will, to have normal living conditions. But it was a very unique experience, and we fully embraced it. We had to pace ourselves shoveling so our backs didn't break, and we tried our best to keep all the buildings in Tuolumne clear of snow. A lot of them are flat-topped roofs, and a lot of them are historic, so we wanted to try to preserve those for the summer use there. But
is this something you have to train for in the off season, so to speak?
There are no shoveling competitions that we attend, but we stay in shape in the summer, being wilderness rangers in Sequoia and National Park. But we are trained ski patrollers in our previous careers, and I think pretty much living and working out there every day, just getting around on foot or on ski is our training.
Now, turning back,
Turning back to Rob, both of you have talked about ski patrol activities and making sure that there aren't any dangerous situations happening out there with people, or if there has been a situation, responding in some way. Given the massive amount of precipitation we had this winter, did that create more problems, or maybe did it keep people away, and were there less problems? How did that work out this year? Were there any rescue situations you were involved in?
Yeah, visitation was pretty low this winter, as you might imagine. Like Laura said, due to the avalanche hazard on the approach from Lee Vining and the condition of the ski and the road, instead of being a flat road grade, turned into a 45-degree slope that ended in a cliff. So it really kept a lot of the visitors at Mammoth and at other ski resorts. There was a two-month period, January and February, where only one hardy soul managed to make it up the Tioga Road from Lee Vining. So in that 62-day period, there was only one other person who was in there, and for us, it felt very isolated. So this winter, we didn't have any active search and rescue missions, but through our blog and through the visitors who did make it out, there were quite a few in late December. And once the real heavy weather had ended in March and April, that was the time when visitation picked up. And with our weekly blog and by making frequent trips down to the ski hut to contact the visitors, we try to play an active role in preventing those type SARs.
So walk me through this situation when the one person in that two-month period showed up. How is that like a Stanley and Livingston sort of experience where this person comes out of the snow, the first person you've seen in months? What was that like?
Well, I'm actually the one who encountered him, and he was at the ski hut pretty exhausted from his trek in and was actually afraid to go back out because of what he had experienced. But that's kind of why we are there, to give advice and encouragement and help when needed out there. The weather cleared, and he ultimately was able to make it out by himself. But it was different seeing a different, I probably talked his ear off there at the ski hut for a little while, but we were on our way to our snow survey, so we kind of had a lot of other work going on at the time. But it's always fun to meet characters out there, because we get folks who are young and old, some people who have been coming to Tuolumne for decades in the winter to spend a week there and escape the front country, if you will, and the city life. And also, there's a lot of new skiers. The equipment has become a lot more user-friendly, and we're getting a lot of younger generation skiers who are a little more extreme, potentially, in the lines that they choose to ski, and we're there if anybody gets hurt or if anything goes wrong, especially if they can't fly the helicopter due to the weather out there.
Now, you're wilderness rangers in Sequoia National Park during the summer part of your season, so you're used to being out alone. What is it? How do the two experiences compare? I mean, that's truly a wilderness experience that you're getting in the wintertime. Not that Sequoia isn't, but how do you compare the two?
Yeah, in the summer months, obviously, we see many more visitors. My ranger station is in the shadow of Mount Whitney and on the John Muir Trail, which has become exceedingly more popular over the years. So you're right. In the wintertime, it's much more isolated in Tuolumne Meadows, and this is sort of the career path we've chosen, so this is what we prefer. I mean, if you can imagine parking your car and skiing or hiking away for 3.5 months and only being powered by your own feet on skis or hiking, it's much simpler, you know, if you can imagine where it's a little more complicated is buying supplies for those seasons, because we have to stock up our stores in Tuolumne Meadows. We buy 5 months worth of groceries over the course of 3 or 4 days, and it's kind of a shock to the system. But once once our stores are in place, it's very simple living, and it's the way we prefer it.
What's the strangest thing that's happened during your time as a winter ranger up at Tuolumne Meadows in the winter? Is there anything especially that stands out to you, either Laura or Rob?
Well, the one that comes to mind just from this winter occurred on a wintry night in early February when we had spent the day with shovels in our hands keeping our tunnels going to the various facilities open and had been in bed for a couple of hours when we heard this crash come from the kitchen, and we're like, what was that? It startled us both out of a very sound sleep, and we went into the kitchen to discover that an avalanche had come off of the roof, and because of the big snow piles that surrounded our house, the sliding snow had nowhere to go and it had blasted through our porch doors and left about knee-high snow piled up in our kitchen. So we had to get our shovels back out and clear out our living space in our PJs. That was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Quite a change from the prior year. The avalanche busted down the door in your kitchen.
How long
does it take to clear something like that?
Oh, thankfully didn't take too long. It was more just a surprise factor, I think, of having to wake up in the night and thinking maybe that the whole roof is going to collapse, but thankfully it was just the door getting pushed in.
Is there any other job like yours? It has to be one of the most unique ones in the world.
Yeah, we've thought about that, and we've never met anybody who has similar job. There's winter caretakers at various places, but to be in such a grand place as Yosemite Park and Tuolumne Meadows, when that place shuts down in the winter, if you've been there in the summertime, and I'm sure a lot of the people listening on the radio have, to experience it in the winter is just a different world altogether, and we feel very fortunate to have the opportunity to serve the public and to spend winters in Tuolumne Meadows. I think you're right. I don't know of any other jobs that like those, and we feel very fortunate to have been able to do it for six winters, and we hope to return for our seventh next year. We'll see what Mother Nature has in store for us then.
We certainly look forward to that, and 2016-2017 was truly a historic year. Rob and Laura Paluski, winter rangers, they spent the winter at Tuolumne Meadows in Yosemite National Park all the way through late April. They're now in their summer job as wilderness rangers in Sequoia National Park along the John Muir Trail, joining us today on the phone here on Valley Public Radio. Rob and Laura, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Joe. We appreciate it.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Over the last few years, many Valley counties have seen their budgets improve when it comes to revenue. That's not been the case, though, in Kern County. That's because California's leading oil producer gets a lot of its money from property taxes, and the valuation of that land is based on the value of the oil that remains in the ground. When the price of oil goes up, so do county tax receipts, and when it goes down, property taxes take a hit, and so does the county's general fund. That's left the county with a $41 million budget shortfall this year, and county officials are looking at ways to fill the gap. Most recently, their gaze has been targeted at the Kern County Fire Department. Last month, the Board of Supervisors voted to hire an outside company to examine the practices of the fire department and ways the county might be able to save money, especially when it comes to overtime. I recently spoke with County Administrative Officer Ryan Alsop to learn a little more about what's going on and how he responds to criticism of the county's actions. So the review that's underway right now, or is about to get underway, of the Kern County Fire Department and its operations, its budget, why hire this outside company to look at this? What are you hoping to find?
Well, we're hoping to get some options. We don't have a whole lot of options when it comes to our fire department, which is basically run out of a single budget unit. That's the fire fund. That fund is directly tied to property taxes, and that fund has taken a hit. They've got a $9.1 million structural deficit in that fund. And when taken as a whole, our whole problem in the county is about a $41 million structural deficit. The fire fund by itself is about a quarter of that whole problem. So we don't have a lot of options. The options that we do have, one is ramping down the number of firefighters in a certain number of stations, which we put a hold on and stopped because, the fire department wanted us to and asked us to, said they had issues with that, said it could jeopardize firefighter safety, and we listened to them on that. And the other option is going after overtime, and it's not all overtime that firefighters are making, but it is a portion of overtime that is paid out not just to firefighters but to other public safety groups here in the county that is over and above what is required by federal law. So it's a small overtime bump that is being paid out to fire that we shouldn't be paying out. And we certainly shouldn't be paying out that bump when we're in a fiscal emergency. So that's what we're trying to go after. And they don't want to do that either. So we don't have a lot of options. The audit, the analysis is really meant to be of use to all of us, the fire chief, the firefighters union, the CAO's office, the board, in figuring out, do we have some options to save some money going forward?
Does something like the Erskine fire kind of throw last year out of whack, or is that just already factored into the budget?
No, that's an extraordinary event. I mean, that kind of an event obviously will skew data, but I can tell you that that the overtime costs in the fire department are always above and beyond whatever anybody else is in the county, and so it's not the Erskine fire really doesn't have a whole lot to do with it. This is a an issue that's always been around, but again, it's a portion of overtime, and it's the way the county currently calculates and defines hours worked. It gets a little complicated, and I don't want to get into the weeds, but it's not going after overtime. It's going after a small percentage of the overtime that is paid out to firefighters that we shouldn't be paying them according to federal law.
You mentioned the fire union, the firefighters union, and they have been critical of this latest review, saying, why not apply this to all departments in the county? If it's good management to go ahead and have sometimes an outside look at what's working and what's not working, why not do this with other
Sure.
county departments?
Well, we might. We very well might. But I got to tell you, it's hard enough doing it with one, which is why there's the interest. And so my response to that and to your listeners is we're going to do one at a time, and we're starting with fire because they're the biggest fish. And if I can solve the problem in the fire department's budget, which is a big problem, again, it's a quarter, 25% of the county's overall fiscal problem. If I can solve that problem, if I can get the fire fund healthy, if I can get them on track to being healthy going forward and have a sustainable budget, that's going to help everybody. To the extent that we do not solve the fire department's fiscal problems, they continue to suck money away from the general fund to patch up their own budget. So we are going to patch up the fire department's budget this year largely with one-time revenues. Some of those revenues will be taken from the county's general fund and reserves. Sheriff relies on the general fund for their operations. The DA relies on the general fund for her operations. The public defender. There are lots of county departments that are important. Parks, libraries, We need to have good parks throughout our county. I mean, I think residents value that. I'm not saying to have good parks at the expense of public safety. I guess what I'm saying is if we can get the fire department and their fiscal house in order, it alleviates a gigantic burden that is placed on all other departments.
Ryan Alsop is the county administrative officer for the County of Kern. He joins us today on Valley Public Radio. Ryan, thanks so much.
You bet.
After a 5-year absence, CSU Summer Arts is back in the Valley. It's presenting a month-long series of classes and public events from June 25th through July 22nd at Fresno State. It's presented in conjunction with the College of Arts and Humanities at the university. And we have two guests from CSU Summer Arts joining us right now in our studio, Joanne Sharp, the assistant director, and Tanya Asageda, a community relations specialist for CSU Summer Arts. Joanne, I want to start with you. First of all, welcome back to the Valley.
Thank you.
Great to have Summer Arts back here in the community. For listeners who aren't familiar with what Summer Arts is all about, give us a thumbnail sketch of what goes on at a Summer Arts event in general before we get to the specifics of what's coming up over the next month.
Sure. CSU Summer Arts is a California State University system-wide program in which we put on master classes in all the different disciplines of the arts: theater, music, dance, visual arts, media arts, literary arts. And we bring in the best artists in the world to come and teach these master classes. As part of their residencies, many of the artists will also give a public event, and that's what makes up our public event season. So all day long, students are attending classes. They are living together on campus. They are eating their meals together. They are just immersed in their art. And then just about every night of the summer, there's a different public event for them to go and see: a reading, a lecture, a play, a concert, a dance concert. So it's just a big educational and celebrational festival of the arts.
So for many years, the program was based here in Fresno. At least it's in its events. It's run out of the chancellor's office down in Long Beach. But for the last 5 years, you were at CSU Monterey. Why did Summer Arts come back to the Valley?
Summer Arts came back to the Valley. We go out to bid, actually, about every 5 years. It's a competitive bidding process. About 9 campuses actually started the bidding process, and Fresno State just came in really strong right off the bat. It was clear that this town loved having us here, and we also loved being here. It's a wonderful place to do this program, and so they won the bidding process, and here we are back again for at least another 5-year term.
So who are these students?
The students are about 65% currently enrolled Cal State students from all 23 different Cal State schools. The other 35% of our students are just artists from all over the world. Some are faculty at Cal States or the universities. Some are working professionals. Some are students at other universities. So all of them, though, are professionals or pre-professional at their craft already.
So this is a sort of a different spin on a summer school type program or a summer semester type program, not necessarily straight out of the university catalog.
No, absolutely not. The courses are 2 weeks long. They're super intense. Students will be working 8 to 16 or more hours a day specifically on their discipline. They are eating, sleeping, and breathing arts while they're working with us. And it's not, this is not where you would come and say, take a guitar class to learn to play the guitar. This is where, if you were already a near expert guitar player, you would come to get this kind of really intensive training to just take your skills to the next level.
So, Joanne, you've been with Summer Arts for a long time. Tanya, you're relatively new here as the program's coming back to Fresno. What's the community response been like with the return of Summer Arts?
You know, it's been phenomenal, actually. I go out, one of my jobs is just kind of go out and talk about the program, and I don't even have to tell people what it is. Their faces light up, they get excited, and they say, where can I go and buy tickets? So it's been really nice to work with a group of people in a project that people love so dearly, and Fresno's ready for it to come back.
So let's go and look at some of the things that are coming up. And you have a really, really interesting lineup of different sorts of artists, you have a Latin jazz, you've got some great cinematographers, you've got the guy who blew up the original Death Star in the original Star Wars. That is quite a feat.
Right. He's not a demolitions expert. He's an effects cinematographer, but yes, he is the person in charge of blowing up the original Death Star. So yeah, and he's amazing. That Bruce Logan is his name. This is his second time coming to Summer Arts. And we just had an extraordinary time with him the last time he was here. And he, just as a person, exemplifies some of the magic that can happen at Summer Arts. He went out to see our student showcases, which I know we'll talk about in a little bit, to see what the students had created. And he was literally geeking out over the work that our students created. He, Bruce Logan, was passing out his business card to our students in our video projection mapping course saying, I want to talk to you. How did you do this? The work you're doing is amazing. And the students are, their heads are exploding because Bruce Logan is handing out his business card to them. And my head was exploding because this is the kind of thing that is why I've been at Summer Arts for 23 years. It never gets old. It never loses its excitement and magic, these interactions that happen.
So he'll be doing a public event. You also have Grammy Award-winning Latin jazz artist David Sanchez bringing his band to the Valley as part of this. I know Latin music is often a part of the Summer Arts curriculum. What's going on there?
That's a very exciting Latin jazz concert that we're doing. You know, this town loves that. And we actually have sort of a couple other offerings. We're doing a percussion course in the second 2 weeks also that really focuses on Afro-Cuban, Afro-Caribbean, Afro-Brazilian rhythm. So that's got another, you know, fun salsa samba bent. And then our dance concert on June 26th with Contratiempo. It is not Latin jazz, but Contratiempo is an urban Latin dance company, and they blew me away the last time I saw them. So that's just another, you know, culturally exciting event.
So we've only got a couple minutes left. Okay. I want to hit a couple more things, though. Okay. The culmination concerts, what are those all about?
So every Summer Arts course, and there are 18 of them going on at Fresno State this year, will culminate in a student presentation of what they've been doing for the past 2 weeks. These are going to be exhibits or readings or concerts or dance performances or theatrical performances or shows of their animation. They're free. They're open to the public. They happen all day long on July 7, 8, 21, and 22. And it's just a chance to come to campus, walk around, visit a whole bunch of different events, and see the really extraordinary work that our students have created.
So you have the public events, you have the culminations. Those are all open to the public, but enrollment is still open also. If people want more information about that or any of this, what should they do?
Well, they should start by going to csusummerarts.org and getting all the information. There are links that you can click for the classes, and it says really clearly on the class list which classes are still open and which are closed at this point. And then there's a link where they can click to view the public events calendar. Tickets are also on sale now. They can just click straight through and start buying tickets for the public events.
Again, it's June 25th through July 22nd at Fresno State. CSU Summer Arts returning to the Valley after 5 years away. Some great public events and student performances. Joanne Sharp, Assistant Director of Summer Arts, and Tanya Acevedo, Community Relations Specialist for the group. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Joe.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, or send us a tweet. We are at KVPR and at Valley Edition. You can subscribe to our Valley Edition podcast and find audio archives of all of our stories on the web at kvpr.org as well. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, our intern Laura Tsutsui, Don Weaver, our production and operations manager, and Marv Allen, audio engineer, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. and by the California Healthcare Foundation, celebrating 20 years dedicated to advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. chcf.org.